plenty for her needs, and she was a heck of a shot. Her nephew told her so. Her husband's eyes grew wide as she brought the weapon up. He didn't say anything or try to be a hero. Bonnie had this. She shifted her body sideways in the booth, head toward the wall, feet toward the aisle and the threat. She was aware of the booth across from her, which was thankfully empty, making her shoot-don't-shoot decision a little simpler. Bonnie's finger tightened on the trigger as the front sight of her Kimber covered a tall and slovenly Hispanic man who was clutching a pistol that was tucked down into his waistband. He staggered, dragging his feet as if he were intoxicated. Definitely a bad guy. A male voice to the left suddenly yelled, "FBI!" causing her to pause her shot. Bonnie hardly had time to blink before the red-headed woman in the next booth swung around a corner with a long pepper grinder in both hands like a baseball bat. She bashed the tall man in the face, dropping him at the same moment that a second man, this one with a flat nose, staggered by. His attention split between the FBI agent behind him and the woman who'd just bashed his friend in the face, and the flat-nosed man roared, spewing curses in Spanish as he drew a black pistol from under his shirt. Bonnie Picaro let the man's silhouette blur, focusing on the Kimber's front sight as she pressed the double-action-only trigger. Her instructor had told her over and over that slow was smooth and smooth was fast. The pistol barked twice. It was so loud on the range, but oddly to Bonnie, it seemed to make no noise as it fired. She wasn't even sure it had fired, and then thought maybe she'd missed if it had. The man with the flat nose just turned his head to look at her, as though he was put out by her behavior. He started to bring his gun around, but she'd already adjusted her aim and pressed the trigger again. The Kimber's third bullet punched an almost perfect hole in the bridge of his flat nose. He lingered there for a moment, then pitched sideways on top of his dazed friend, who'd just been smacked with the pepper grinder. "FBI," a man's voice said again to her left. "Ma'am, please put down your weapon." Bonnie slowly lowered the Kimber to the table before raising both empty hands above her head. She'd trained for this as well. Across the table, Mike stared at her slack-jawed, as if he wasn't quite certain who he'd been sleeping with for the last 44 years. Dominic Caruso secured the blonde woman's revolver while he aimed his own weapon at the guy Callahan had clobbered with a pepper grinder. Callahan had her handcuffs out and was already moving in. She looked up at the blonde. "You okay?" "He was going to shoot you," the woman said. Her hands were still up, but she was remarkably composed for someone who'd just blown off the back of a man's skull. Callahan slapped the cuffs on the moaning assassin and smiled. "You can relax, ma'am," she said. "Lucky for me, you're a good shot." She looked up at Caruso. "And that you had the good sense to call my cell. I knew something was up because you'd just left. I did a quick peek over the booth and saw these rocket scientists wander in." Caruso scanned the restaurant, looking for any other would-be assassins. These guys tended to travel in packs. He saw no immediate threats, but what he did see was at least 5 more restaurant patrons with their hands either on the butt of an exposed sidearm or in a purse getting ready to draw one. "FBI," he said again. "Everyone please relax and keep your firearms where they are." He chuckled and helped Callahan to her feet. "Texas appears to be a bad place to become an assassin." The blonde citizen who'd saved the day gave a solemn nod, her hands just beginning to shake from the post-shooting adrenaline dump. "You got that right, hon," she said. Chapter 37. The alarm on Jack Ryan Jr.'s cell phone began to chime at 2 a.m., nudging him awake with gradually increasing volume. He'd read somewhere that being jolted out of a deep sleep was a good way to suffer brain damage, and if that was the case, he and most of the people he knew were in serious trouble. He pumped out 30 quick push-ups to clear his head and then suffered through a moment of benign panic that there was no hot water in the shower, until he remembered that the C on the faucet did not stand for cold, After a shower that was plenty caliente, he wiped the fog off the mirror and took a few moments to square away his beard with a razor and a small pair of scissors he carried for that purpose. He'd recently shaved down to a mustache, but he was glad to have the beard back. People said he looked like his dad. He didn't see it. The full beard kept others from seeing it as well. Ryan had taken the time to lay out his clothes and gear before his nap. He shot a quick glance at the tritium hands on his watch, just 4 hours before. The area recon had been interesting, if only for total immersion in the Europeanness of Buenos Aires. Lizanne Robertson had dropped Adara off an hour and a half behind the others, and stayed to check personally that the rental car company had come through on their promise. The valet in the lobby of the Panamericano Hotel assured her that there was a Peugeot 408 and a Renault Duster parked in the garage. Like just about every other rental vehicle in Argentina, both had manual transmissions, a fact that drew a twinkle from every campus member's eye. They'd all attended numerous driving schools, and there was nothing like a stick shift to spur the last few horses out of an otherwise humdrum ride. Lizanne had grudgingly returned to her airport hotel only after a direct order from Chavez. She'd suggested she could provide counter-surveillance and force protection. It sounded like a good idea to Ryan, but Ding would have none of it. They'd given Adara a few minutes to check in and get settled before spending the next 3 hours doing recon around Parisia Aires Criollos. Any surveillance of Vincent Chen was likely to end up on foot anyway, so they opted to leave the vehicles parked and walk the few blocks between the hotel and the restaurant. It was their only lead, so they would exploit it until they found something better. They'd walked in teams of two, going north on Avenida Nuevo de Julio, with Jack and Adara making up one team while Chavez and Midas brought up the rear. 9th of July Avenue, so named for the date of Argentina's independence from Spain, was lined with a greenbelt and many parks and fountains on either side. It was touted as the widest city street in the world. Ryan had been warned not to refer to himself as an American. People in South America took issue with citizens of the United States co-opting that title for themselves. Argentines customarily took siestas in the afternoon and worked late. It was dark by the time the team had ventured out, and many businessmen and women were just beginning to get off work. Avenida Nuevo de Julio was flooded with tourists at this temperate time of the South American spring. Members of the middle and upper classes tended to dress in business casual for nearly all endeavors that didn't require business dress. It had been an easy matter for Jack to pick out the T-shirt and Bermuda shorts wearing tourists in the crowds. Argentina's high inflation made for a thriving underground currency exchange, called arbolitos, or little trees, for their propensity to spring up everywhere. These men and women stood at strategic points along the avenue, usually in front of stores that sold high-end merchandise, and whispered, cambio, cambio, change, change, as wealthy tourists walked by. Their jobs required arbolitos to carry a large amount of cash, and though it was probably lost on an average tourist, Ryan noted that there was always a second standing a few yards away, no doubt protecting the person, but also, more important for the black market investors, the money. The campus operators had strolled through the Recoleta district, exploring the iconic cemetery and El Gran Gomero, the enormous, supposedly 200-year-old rubber tree, the crown of which spanned 50 meters. Ryan found it pleasant and even refreshing to incorporate a little tourism into his recon, even if he was out for a walk with his cousin's girlfriend and not a girlfriend of his own. This line of work sucked the life out of relationships. Eventually, he and Adara had used a visit to the inside of Parisia Aires Criollos as an excuse to have a nice sit-down dinner. Chavez and Midas waited outside. No one thought there was much danger that they were being followed yet, but the last thing they wanted to do was huddle up together in a venue of interest to Vincent Chen. Beyond that, Ding had been to Argentina before, and he knew a place that made killer empanadas. It was across the street from the sprawling branches of the giant rubber tree. The evening had ended by 10 o'clock, after a zigzagging surveillance detection route back to the Panamericano. They'd talked over the plan for the coming day on the radio as they walked. Chavez was reluctant to discuss anything in the room of a foreign hotel, even in a relatively friendly country like Argentina. It was decided that they would meet at 2:30 the next morning and take a circular route back to the airport by way of the Chinese embassy at the edge of the Saavedra district in the northern part of the city. "Don't be late," Midas said, still a little grouchy about eating fried meat pies while Ryan got to have an Argentinian beefsteak. "And don't be light." Ryan didn't intend to be late or light. Freshly showered and shaved now, he looked at his watch again and then rubbed a dab of gel into his dark hair before brushing his teeth. For the same reason they didn't discuss logistics in foreign hotel rooms, he was careful about displaying his pistol or other gear. He'd checked the obvious locations for bugs and hidden cameras, using a handheld device Gavin Beery had issued each campus operator to scan for RF interference, and then looked for the telltale glint of pinhole camera lenses by taking a few flash photos of each wall with his phone, and then studying them for reflections. Ryan found nothing, but since he was a good spy, that only made him more suspicious. He used the half-open closet door to conceal most of his body while he geared up. Cameras and microphones needed electricity, and though campus operators themselves often used battery-powered devices, when possible they tied into existing sources, especially when running a long-term or open-ended op. Ryan himself hadn't known he was coming to Argentina until the day before, so any cameras that did happen to exist would likely have been set up to catch targets of opportunity. Those units would need a power source. There was no light inside the closet, and Ryan reasoned that apart from it being a sucky place to put a device, any foreign operative worth his or her salt would place any cameras in more productive locations. With his movements hidden by the open door, he popped the Smith & Wesson's magazine, then seated it firmly back in place. He retracted the slide a scant half inch. He'd been the last to touch the weapon, but as Clark hammered home at least once during every tactical scenario, press checks were free insurance. Reassured the pistol was loaded, Ryan held it at arm's length, acquiring the front sight with his dominant eye, the same way he did each time he picked up the weapon, even to put it away. This was bound to be a long day, and a long day of surveillance required clothing that was comfortable. Equally important, it required clothing that did not stand out. If his clothes could be changed or altered through the day, so much the better. Ryan decided on a pair of light chinos and a pale blue button-down Oxford shirt with long sleeves. The slacks were loose enough to hide his Thunderwear holster, and the shirt thick enough to conceal the neck loop and mic of his communication gear. He and the other members of the team customarily carried a folding clip knife. Ryan chose a Benchmade called Big Summit Lake. It wasn't as tactic-cool as a black knife, but was razor-sharp and large enough to do the job. Wooden scales made it look more like a tool than a weapon. In addition to their people-killing knives, they'd all opted for what Midas called granddad blades, smaller folders that could be used to assist with the chores normal people used knives for, bypassing locks and cutting cordage. Ryan had learned the hard way that he'd rather be attacked by just about anything besides a knife. Conversely, he'd rather launch an attack of his own with just about anything else. He dropped the radio the size of a pack of playing cards into the pocket of his slacks and slipped into a pair of lace-up Rockport boatbuilder high tops before shrugging on a navy blue blazer. Last, he opened a flat plastic pill case and removed one of two beige earpieces about the size of the nail on his little finger. He replaced the small hearing aid battery that was nearly as large as the device, not wanting to risk comms failure at an inopportune moment. Batteries never died after they finished an op, failing instead at the most critical moments. Ryan chuckled to himself as he dropped a spare battery into the inside pocket of his sport coat. James Bond and Jason Bourne made it look easy, but there was sure a lot of technical shit to worry about in this business. Removing the chair he habitually propped against any hotel door, he did one final testicles, spectacles, wallet, and comb check to make certain he had everything he needed, and then headed into the hallway, leaving the Por favor, no molestar sign hanging on the handle. He made it to the lobby at 2:25 a.m., teaming up with Midas in the blue Peugeot 408, which, to Jack's surprise, was turbocharged. The streets were far from empty at 3 in the morning, but the traffic was light enough that Jack had no trouble keeping Chavez and Adara and their Renault in sight as they headed northwest on Avenida del Libertador. The two-car caravan worked its way through Barrio Chino and then drove west to do a quick drive-by of the Chinese embassy. The Peugeot was far from quick off the line, especially compared to his Beamer back home, but Jack found it zippy enough to get him into trouble at intersections. Buenos Aires seemed completely devoid of four-way stops. According to the guidebook, the vehicle with the most momentum carried the right-of-way, and for a damn-the-torpedoes hard charger like Jack, that came in pretty handy. Adara's voice came over the net as they passed the high walls of the embassy. "Here be dragons." "No doubt," Ryan said, "but just what kind of dragons remains to be seen." They continued west, eventually hitting Avenida General Paz and taking it south until it joined the autopista back to Ministro Pistarini International. Chavez went into the terminal while the others posted outside. The rain had stopped, but the early morning air was still cool enough to be bracing. Ding came over Ryan's earpiece less than an hour later. "Heads up, guys," he said. "A blonde female just met our guy and one other Asian male when they cleared customs." "A blonde, you say?" Adara said. "Interesting." "That's a firm," Chavez said. "I have one more Asian male in the middle of the pack behind Chen and his buddy. So far they haven't had any interaction, but that doesn't surprise me. Chen's wearing gray slacks and a black three-button. His buddy's in jeans and a white long sleeve. Female is in dark slacks and a fawn blouse." Midas chuckled. "Fawn?" "Yes, fawn," Chavez said. "Like tan." "I see her through the window," Midas said. "Pretty sure that color is wheat." "Dumbass," Chavez said. "The blonde is pulling the bags. I'm right behind them. The lone Asian male is in jeans and a light blue jacket. Jack, you and Midas mark him. See what he does when we get back on the autopista." "Copy that," Jack said. "We'll be..." Ryan paused, watching Chen and his small entourage exit the double doors from the airport. He focused on the blonde who brought up the rear. "Does the female look familiar to anybody?" She didn't, so Jack kept working on the connection, whatever it was, in the back of his mind. There was something about her that struck a nerve. Adara picked up Chavez, but they lingered an extra 2 minutes as though they were waiting for someone else, before pulling around to follow Chen and the others to the parking lot across the street and beyond a row of concrete construction barriers, where they got into a red Chevy compact. "Got him," Midas said a moment later. Jack and he watched the loner load his bag into a black Toyota Hilux pickup and climb into the passenger seat. The black glass was tinted, but Jack thought he could make out a female behind the wheel. Jack counted to 20, then fell in behind the Hilux. Both teams stayed well back in the light traffic of early morning. Where the autopista crossed General Paz, the Hilux took the ramp to go north, generally backtracking the route the campus operators had taken to reach the airport. The Chevrolet continued toward downtown. "You want me to follow?" Jack asked, eyes over the guardrail as he watched the Hilux accelerate northwest while the Chevrolet continued northeast. They could be going to the Chinese embassy. "Negative," Chavez said. "Let's focus on Chen. We're not even certain they're together." "Copy that," Jack said. As usual, there were never enough of them to do perfect surveillance. They followed the Chevy east along Avenida 25 de Mayo, and then wound through the city in what were surely a series of half-hearted surveillance detection routes, only to end up at a tall set of brick apartments off Avenida Santa Fe in the San Isidro neighborhood of Acasuso, northwest of Buenos Aires proper. Adara kept the Renault heading north on Santa Fe, while the Chevy turned left down Libertad, a much smaller street, and came to a stop in front of what looked like a small school or daycare center. Adara came over the net. "That's interesting." "I agree," Midas said. "They wound back through town, when the General Paz would have gotten them here much quicker." "There is that," Adara said. "But the blue Hilux we saw at the airport, it's parked right around the corner." Chapter 38 Ryan and Midas sat in the Peugeot half a block up Libertad from the apartment building, while Adara and Chavez met Lizanne to grab the little Clio she and the pilots had been driving. With Chen turning up with so many Confederates, the team needed a fresh set of wheels. When they returned with the Renault, Ryan and Midas went to check out the neoclassical French mansion that was now the Palacio Duhau Park Hyatt Hotel on Avenida Alvear. The hotel also happened to be located in the swank neighborhood of Recoleta, less than 8 blocks from the Parisia Aires Criollos restaurant, where Argentina's Minister of Agriculture was hosting tonight's dinner. Several U.S. intelligence agencies, including the CIA and National Security Agency, kept tabs on traveling members of foreign governments via both open-source and intercepted signals intelligence, and Gavin Beery's team at Hendley Associates kept tabs on the tabs keepers. A quick check with the IT guru told the campus operators the Chinese foreign minister had chosen the Hyatt for his stay in Buenos Aires. The team was still unsure as to the purpose of Vincent Chen's visit, other than being reasonably certain it had something to do with the Chinese foreign minister. And even that didn't narrow things down very much. They knew someone had bombed a subway tunnel outside of Beijing. Eddie Feng obviously thought Chen was behind the attack. He was Taiwanese, and he had a code name, so it wasn't outside the realm of possibility. They booted around the idea of sending up a warning through the State Department to contact the Chinese delegation regarding a possible threat to the foreign minister, but decided against it for a number of reasons. First, the halls of the government in the People's Republic of China were even more Byzantine than those of the United States. Given the fact that President Ryan had dropped a bomb on a Chinese office building that housed a group of hackers destroying American defense computers, trust between the two nations was less than nil. PRC bureaucrats would see treachery in any U.S. action. They would hold the information while its credibility was verified, ensuring that this was not some ploy to make them lose face, or worse. Any pertinent intelligence regarding a plot against the foreign minister would take days to climb to the top of an actual decision-maker's desk and then trickle back down to his security detail, who now formed a phalanx of armed men in dark suits around Foreign Minister Li, half a block from the spot where Jack Ryan Jr. stood on the sidewalk. Beyond the simple believability of the information, the team also ran the risk that someone from the foreign minister's delegation was an ROC spy, and Chen, being Taiwanese, was his handler, there to collect information. Ryan stood out of sight of the Hyatt on Rodriguez Peña Street, around the corner from the concrete and red brick building that housed the Argentine Ministry of Culture. Midas was farther east down Avenida Alvear, window shopping at a small art gallery across from the hotel. His vantage point gave him an eye on the Hyatt's porte cochere and a direct line of sight to the arriving detail. Ryan spoke into the mic on his neck loop. "See anyone we should recognize?" "Negative," Midas said. Chavez and Adara were too far across town to be in contact via the radio intercom, but Chavez had just confirmed by cell phone that there had been no sign of movement from Chen or his people. Both the Hilux and the Chevy were still parked at the apartments in Acasuso. Ryan and Midas settled into what seemed would be a couple hours of lurking, without looking like lurkers. The Palacio Duhau Park Hyatt was located in an architecturally rich area of Buenos Aires that reminded Jack of Paris, but as nice as the area was, the Ministry of Culture, in front of which he now stood, was covered in graffiti. Ryan couldn't understand the Spanish, but he could tell from the sheer volume that the writing didn't tout confidence and trust in the Argentine government. Even the street around the building was covered in graffiti, though this was made with a stencil and more precise than the spray-painted scrawl on the building's walls. Ryan scuffed at the white paint with the toe of his Rockport. "You speak Spanish, right?" he asked over the radio. "A fair amount," Midas said, knowing the question was meant for him since the others were too far away. "What does Esto Huele Mal mean?" Midas chuckled. "Where'd you see that?" "Painted all over the street in front of the Culture Ministry." "Igrache," Midas said. "I read about that. Argentines are big on shaming elected officials that they feel have done wrong. Graffiti, signage, even screaming at them on airplanes or in public places with megaphones." Ryan laughed. "My dad gets a lot of that." "I voted for him," Midas said. "Anyway, esto huele mal means this smells bad or this stinks. Not sure what..." Ryan cut him off. "Hold on," he said. The urgency in his voice caused Midas to fall silent. Walking up Avenida Alvear, past the Hyatt and almost even with Ryan, was a tall brunette. He turned quickly, looking away before she had a chance to see his face. Jack had seen this woman the evening before, at the restaurant with Adara. It dawned on him that the blonde who met Chen had been with this one. Ryan hadn't been able to see more than her profile from his vantage point, but the brunette had been facing him. The two women had definitely been together. He saw no headphones or Bluetooth earpiece, but the brunette spoke to someone as she walked. Perhaps, Ryan thought, utilizing the same sort of hidden microphone and neck loop he wore. He started to follow, but caught sight of an Asian woman from the corner of his eye. She was about the same age as the brunette, early 30s, with high cheekbones framed by shoulder-length hair. She stepped out of a side door of a building connected to the Hyatt, waited a beat while the brunette walked past, and then fell in behind her. She was dressed nicely in snug jeans and a loose designer t-shirt, but she bore angry pink scratches from jaw to forehead as if she'd slid into home plate on her face. Ryan couldn't tell if her dark eyes were beautiful or terrifying, but he decided he would find out soon enough. He gave Midas a quick brief over the radio. "Good catch," Midas said. "I don't know about the Asian, but the brunette has to be in comms with Chen. She's probably letting him know the foreign minister had arrived." "That's my guess." Ryan looked over his shoulder at traffic before crossing the street after the Asian, who seemed to be locked on to the brunette. "I'm going to stick with them and see where they go." "Stay in range for comms," Midas said. "I'll reach out to Ding and bring him up to speed." The Asian woman took a right at the first block, while the brunette went straight. Ryan knew it was stupid, but he was more than a little disappointed. Maybe she wasn't involved at all. The leggy brunette continued walking against traffic on Alvear for several blocks, past the popping flags of the Palace Hotel and two sets of arbolitos, touting their money exchange outside high-end shops selling Mont Blanc and Rolex. Any preconceived notions Jack had on this surveillance were quickly dashed. The Asian woman was nowhere in sight, and now the brunette wasn't going to her car as he'd first assumed. She turned right, as if to head back to the Retiro train station. A block later, she turned left again. "Northwest on Libertador," Jack said, as much to make sure he still had a clear signal with Midas as to update him on the location. "Copy that," Midas said. "This is weird," Jack said. "Asian girl has broken off. Doesn't look to be a factor. I can't tell if this one is doing a really basic SDR or just zigzagging her way to wherever she's going. So far, she hasn't even checked behind her." "Watch your ass," Midas said. "Maybe she's not alone. Your Asian woman could turn up again soon and stick a knife in your fourth point of contact." "That's a nice thought," Ryan said, watching the woman trot across Avenida del Libertador. Risking one's life against 10 lanes of aggressive Argentine drivers made for the perfect method to shed a tail. Ryan tried to keep the woman in his peripheral vision as he continued up the street toward the crosswalk, willing himself to remain at a normal pace. The signal turned green just as the brunette disappeared into the trees. No one would think twice about someone running to beat the crossing signal on such a wide street, so Ryan made up some time sprinting toward the park. He slowed when he reached the grass, staying parallel to what the brunette's route would be if she went straight after entering the trees. The park was a fairly narrow one, and a railway yard with numerous tracks, switches, and uncoupled train cars lay directly on the other side, spilling out of Retiro Station to the south. This yard formed a natural line of demarcation between the upscale Recoleta neighborhood and the shanty town of broken brick dwellings in a warren of narrow streets known as Villa 31, one of many such slums in Buenos Aires, collectively and appropriately called Villas Miseria. Nearly 15 city blocks long and more than 5 blocks wide at its widest point, the Villa, Argentines pronounced it Villa, was a gray swath of nothingness next to the tracks on most maps. Tourists might think it was just part of the train yard, close enough that its residents could smell meat cooking from Recoleta restaurants if the wind was right. Villa 31 was home to many of the hardest-working people in Buenos Aires, as well as some of the city's most violent criminals. Maids and service workers who lacked the proper references to rent an apartment in the city often paid half as much to rent a room with a communal bath and pirated electricity in a crumbling departamento from one of the neighborhood bosses who ran everything from rent collection to dispute enforcement inside the Villa. Villa 31 was a city within a city, but few people admitted to living there. Police braved the streets only in well-armed squads, and then only during daylight hours. If someone needed an ambulance at night, as Ding Chavez put it, forget about it. Ryan caught sight of the brunette a moment later, 100 feet away and walking in his direction. He sat down on a bench across from a weathered older man who was throwing pistachios to a chattering flock of bright green parrots about the size of small pigeons. Ryan put his back to a gum tree, but used the man's eyes and expressions to help guard his 6 o'clock. It wasn't an optimum setup, but human beings usually reacted in some way to danger, and Jack couldn't very well keep looking over his shoulder all the time. The birds and the man ignored him. The brunette worked her way through the waist-high grass and weeds along the rail yard fence until she found what she was looking for, a gap in the chain link. Jack imagined the same makeshift gate was used by commuters from Villa 31 each morning and evening to and from their jobs, so they didn't have to walk all the way to the other side of Retiro Station to get over the tracks. If the brunette had seen Ryan, she showed no sign of it. Instead, she turned sideways to slip through the gap, and then, checking both ways for oncoming trains, trotted across multiple sets of railroad tracks. Ryan couldn't help but think she looked like pictures he'd seen of East German refugees fleeing the no-man's land to get over the wall. Reaching the far side, she ducked through a second gap in the railway fence to enter the slums. If it was difficult to follow her through the park, it would be impossible for Jack to follow her into the shantytown. Aside from the prospect that she might see him, venturing into Villa 31 without knowing someone on the inside was a good way to get yourself dead in a hurry. Ryan gave a nod to the man feeding the parrots and headed back toward Midas. He bought a choripan, chorizo sausage on a bun, from a guy in the park, because he didn't know when he'd get to eat again. He'd give Midas a break when he got there. "Lost her," he said, eating as he walked. "I'll explain when I..." "Say again," Midas said. "You cut out." Ryan lowered his voice and dropped the barely eaten choripan into a trash can along the path. "It's her," he said. "The Asian woman. Looks like she's picking the lock on some kind of tool shed or utility building in the park." "Copy," Midas said. Ryan swung wide, keeping to the trees and keeping the small stone building in view. He came around in time to catch a glimpse of the Asian woman's back as she pulled the door shut behind her. The building was maybe 8 by 8 and had no windows. It didn't look like she'd been running from anyone. Jack scratched his beard, thinking through his options. One of them, probably the smartest one, was to walk away. He'd never been very good at that. He listened outside the building for a half a minute. Nothing. The lock fell quickly to his granddad knife. There was nobody inside, though there was only one door, so the Asian woman had to have gone somewhere. Ryan took a small flashlight from his pocket and played it around the small space. There was a lingering smell that he couldn't put his finger on. But it wasn't good. The building looked to be storage for the lawn maintenance department, with a couple of weed eaters and assorted rakes and shovels. A row of plastic trash cans lined a platform along the back wall. One lay on its side, presumably tipped over by the woman. Ryan entertained the idea that she could be hiding in one of the cans. But that was stupid. To what end? She hadn't even known he was following her. He peeked over the edge of each one anyway, at once relieved and disappointed to find them empty. The platform was about 6 inches high and made of weathered wood timbers. It was old, probably older than the building, making Ryan wonder if the place had been used as something other than storage in the past. Closer inspection revealed grass clippings sticking from under the edge of the wood, and when Jack gave it a shove, it moved. He pulled the overturned trash can out of the way, revealing 4 freshly disturbed timbers that formed a 3-foot square. "I'll be damned," he muttered, pushing what was essentially a trap door out to one side. "She's gone underground." "Underground?" Midas said. "Speak to me, brother. What's going on?" "I'm going after her," Ryan said. "Don't be pissed, but I'm pretty sure we're about to lose comms." He coughed at the rank wind that hit him in the face when he moved the boards. "Esuelte something something," he said. Midas came across the net, confused. "What?" "That phrase from the graffiti I asked you about earlier," Ryan said. "It means this stinks, right?" "Huele," Midas corrected. "Esto huele mal." Ryan peered down into the blackness below, pausing for a moment in hopes of picking up any sound of the Asian woman. He heard nothing but the moan of the sickening breeze as it blew upward out of the inky hole. "It sure as hell does," he muttered, half to himself. Chapter 39. Each campus operator carried the same basic components for everyday carry: firearm, knife, flashlight, and cell phone. Some of them, like Clark, carried little else, relying on their pistol and badass experience to get the job done. Dominic Caruso, who'd been trained by the FBI, carried things like extra nylon restraints that looked like shoelaces and even flat rubber stoppers used to block interior doors when searching buildings. Ryan fell somewhere in the middle. In addition to his pistol and an extra 8-round magazine, he carried 2 knives, a small Streamlight Protac flashlight, and a Zippo lighter. His cell phone would be useless for communication underground, but it did provide a backup source of lighting. Adara had issued each operator a small trauma packet containing an envelope of Celox hemostatic gauze and a SWAT-T soft rubber tourniquet. The kit was just one more thing to carry, and he'd be a happy camper if he never had to open the damn thing. But given the dark hole in the ground over which his feet now dangled, he was glad to have it. Ryan thought seriously about ripping up a piece of his shirt and plugging his nose. The smell was so noxious. "Talk to me, Jack," Midas said. "Give me a description of where you're going down." "I'm sending you my Latin long now." "Perfect," Midas said. "That way we'll know where to look for your body. How about you wait for me and I'll come back you up?" "Stay put," Ryan said. "Somebody needs to keep an eyeball on the Chinese delegation. I'll be fine. Just going down to have a little look." "Copy that," Midas said, sounding unconvinced. "My training says to trust the guy on the ground. But watch yourself." "Will do," Ryan said, and lowered himself into the blackness. Ryan found a rusted iron ladder just inside the opening and hooked an arm through the top rung while he dragged the wooden cover back into place. He was hesitant to use his light, concerned that it would tip off the Asian woman that he was behind her, and he counted 9 rungs before his feet splashed into something cold and oozing. The awful smell told him it probably wasn't water. Though it was only ankle deep, his rock ports were going to be good for nothing but a short trip to the nearest dumpster when he made it back above ground. Pausing in the pitch blackness, he fought the urge to gag and strained to hear any sign of the departing woman. When he heard nothing, he drew his pistol and decided to take a chance with the flashlight. Ryan found himself completely alone at the bottom of a deep tube of red brick and mortar, approximately 30 feet in diameter. It looked like an old grain silo set in the ground. 4 arched brick doorways, each about the same size as his 6-foot wingspan, ran from the sides of the cavern with what was presumably sewage flowing out of the 2 doors to his left and into the 2 to his right toward the Rio de la Plata. The bricks at the base of the arch to Jack's immediate right had telltale splash marks on one side. Closer inspection revealed hair-like moss just below the surface. The color of unripe limes, the moss swayed and billowed with the current like some kind of primordial ooze. By holding the powerful beam of the streamlight at a low angle, Jack could see an obvious trail of discoloration in the moss, made by the weight of recent footprints. Most of the moss was undisturbed. He followed, moving slowly, pistol held back near his waist and flashlight slightly away from his body. Every few seconds, he stopped and listened. But he heard nothing except the gurgle of flowing water. Or whatever this was. Buenos Aires was old, first settled sometime in the late 1500s. It was already a thriving city by the time the 13 American colonies north of the equator declared their independence from England. There were tunnels under cities all over the world, the catacombs beneath Paris, waterworks of an old wool business under Bradford, England, and abandoned sewers crisscrossing subterranean New York City. Ryan remembered from his history classes at Georgetown that Jesuit priests used a series of hidden tunnels here to move secretly between their numerous churches, both in centuries past and in more recent times of bloodshed during the Dirty War, when the military junta ferreted out communist insurgents and anyone else they deemed to be a dissident. Some of the tunnels had been discovered and were now in the guidebooks. Some remained hidden. Others had been flooded by overflowing groundwater and sewer systems. This one was covered with a wooden door, obviously known to someone besides the Asian woman. Small niches, approximately 1 foot high and half as deep, were built into the brick walls, as if meant for statuary, leading Ryan to believe this tunnel wasn't originally intended to be a sewer. He passed 3 smaller archways splitting off from the main tunnel as he sloshed along, 1 to the right and 2 more to the left. The trail of discolored moss told him to continue straight ahead. 20 minutes after he'd first splashed down in the tunnels, Ryan came to another rusted iron ladder on the wall. The tunnel continued into the darkness, but the ladder was wet. Someone had recently climbed up. Ryan felt like he'd been going generally east, and he suspected he was somewhere near the marina on the Rio de la Plata, but it was impossible to know for sure without going up to peek out. When he stood completely still, he thought he could hear laughter. He holstered his pistol and dropped the flashlight back into his pocket. Faint pinholes of light shone down from something at the top. Ryan hauled himself upward rung by rung, going slowly enough to let the sewage drain from his boots. He was careful not to slip. Walking through shit was one thing. Going for a swim in it was a whole other ballgame. He was reasonably certain he'd been vaccinated against hepatitis. Probably. Maybe. He began to mull over the idea of contracting cholera or jungle rot or whatever bug might swim up a person's toenails from fetid water. A bath in Clorox was starting to sound inviting by the time he wrapped one arm around the top rung and put the flat of his hand against a metal grate. Ryan pushed up slowly, peering under the edge at a pile of steaming donkey crap inches away. He knew very little about barnyard scatology, but the donkey that had manufactured the stuff happened to be standing right above it. A quick look around said he'd not been going east at all, but north. The dirt streets and broken block buildings could be nowhere else but Villa 31, the same place where the tall brunette had disappeared. Frenzied Spanish voices, most male, but at least one female, jerked Ryan's attention to his left. His vantage point from under the donkey cart allowed him to see little but a set of scrambling feet. They were small and wet, and sliding under the donkey cart, directly for him. Ryan barely had time to yank his head back into the tunnel before the Asian woman shoved the metal grating aside, pulling it shut behind her as she slid feet first into the hole, landing squarely on Ryan's knuckles where they curled around the pitted metal rung. Ryan was strong, but the impact of 120 pounds of fleeing woman knocked him off the ladder. Customarily, Ryan would have tucked his head and rolled when falling from 10 or 12 feet, but something told him he'd be better off with a broken leg than swimming in this slimy muck. The scant 10 inches of water did little to break his fall, but he did his best to absorb much of the impact with bent knees. The floor of the tunnel was at a slight angle, and he was just able to keep his feet, surfing on the snot-slick moss when he splashed down, wildly waving both arms in an effort to keep from falling face first into the sewage. It was far from graceful, but it worked. He spun in time to see the shadow of the Asian woman slide to the bottom of the ladder behind him. Floundering for just a moment, she wasted no time before sloshing off toward her original point of entry. Jack limped to go after her, but his right knee rebelled, slowing him down to a fast hobbling limp. Lighter than Jack by nearly 100 pounds, and a hell of a runner, the Asian woman looked over her shoulder directly at Jack, her eyes wide. "Nigero," she said. "Run!" The way she spoke was full of urgency, and he felt certain it was Japanese. Ryan heard a splash behind him and turned to face a man with a machete who'd just come down the ladder. The wiry man stood with his mouth hanging open and the machete raised above his head. He was alone and looked almost as surprised as Jack felt. "Friend," Ryan said, peering at the man in the scant light from above. "Amigo?" The man shook his head and grinned, realizing he was the only one with a weapon in hand. Even in the shadows, hell, especially in the shadows, Ryan could see the vacantness in the man's eyes. "You can't reason with evil," Clark always said. So Jack didn't try. He could have tried to draw his pistol, but his hands were wet and slick. Even if he was able to get a shot off, the man would be on top of him in an instant with the heavy blade, making the odds too great that it would be a lose-lose endeavor. Instead, Ryan feinted right, causing the man to swing the blade across his own body. The slick footing made the man's actions more exaggerated, allowing Ryan to shoot in and trap the arm against the other man's chest and drive him backward into the ladder. The snotty moss worked both ways, making it all but impossible for Ryan to keep his opponent trapped. He followed up with a quick headbutt to the bridge of the man's nose. The blow stunned him, but without proper grounding, there hadn't been enough power in it to do much damage.
"Boludo,"
Machete Man grunted, struggling to escape and bring the blade back into play. Jack wasted no effort on words, instead driving his knee into the man's unprotected groin. It worked to dislodge the blade, but unfortunately it also dislodged Ryan, and both men fell, splashing into the flowing, filthy water. Ryan's feet had grown used to the temperature, but the cold liquid hitting his knees took the breath out of him. The other man took the worst of it, landing on his back and slamming his head against the mossy stone floor. Fighting blind, Ryan straddled him, clawed for the face now, feeling and then losing a grip on his chin. Ryan heard him gurgle and then felt a sharp blow to his side. The son of a bitch had gotten a hand free and now proceeded to pummel him in the ribs. A shot went low and took him over the liver, sending waves of pain and nausea through Ryan's gut. He redoubled his efforts, sinking a thumb into the man's eye and forcing his face sideways and into the muck. The man bucked and thrashed, sputtering, trying anything to get his nose above the surface. Ryan braced himself against the slick moss with his free hand as best he could, coming up on his toes and pressing down with all the weight of his body on the other man's chest. He heard a sickening gurgle as the man aspirated a lungful of fetid sewage, and then the struggling ceased. Ryan waited a few more seconds to be sure, and then pushed himself upward, chancing a quick look with his flashlight once he got to his feet. Panting, filth dripping from his nose, he stood with a hand on one knee and vomited. Jack wiped his mouth with the sleeve over his biceps, the only relatively clean portion of his shirt. He spat and opened and shut his eyes several times to clear them, knowing this image would stay with him for a very long time. The silhouette of the other man was barely visible in the shadows as the river of sewage carried him away. That, he thought, was a hell of a way to die. The pain in Jack's knee and ribs had subsided to a dull ache by the time he limped back to the stone building. A quick peek out the cracked door revealed only a young couple feeding some ducks and a uniformed groundskeeper on a riding lawnmower. Ryan knew he was likely to cause an international incident, or at the very least commit aggravated assault to the noses of every Argentine he passed, if he didn't get out of his sewage-soaked clothing. Chavez was grouchy about it, but he told Midas to break away from Foreign Minister Lee's hotel and grab Jack a pair of sweats and his Brooks runners from his room at the Panamericano, along with a half-dozen bottles of water and the biggest container of hand sanitizer Midas could find, which turned out to be not nearly as big as Jack had hoped for. Ryan rinsed off the best he could inside the stone building while Midas stood guard outside. Beyond salvation, everything from his skin out, including the rock ports, went into a dumpster. The fresh clothes and relatively disinfected feet allowed Ryan to make it back to the hotel without drawing too much attention. People who passed him smelled something amiss, but Jack looked clean and tidy. Such an awful stench couldn't be coming from him. Midas led the way and called the elevator while Jack waited by himself in a deserted corner beyond the baby grand piano in the Panamericano's lobby until he was sure they would have the elevator to themselves. He cleaned his gun and other equipment first. Some scrubbing and a few minutes under the blow dryer took care of the Thunderwear holster. It was made of textile, but thankfully it had been semi-protected by his slacks. The radio equipment was waterproof, so it was a fairly straightforward process to get it clean. His watch band, on the other hand, was toast. His cell phone had survived unscathed, but for a cracked screen. 20 minutes in a near-scalding shower and 2 more bottles of hand sanitizer later, Ryan finally felt almost clean again. He briefly considered calling his mother to see if there was some kind of prophylactic medication he should take. But there was no good way to explain his situation to her. "Hey, Mom, I was just tromping around in some South American sewers today, wondering if I should be worried." He decided he'd ask Adara if he got the chance. Ryan had to will himself to take it easy on the aftershave, knowing too much would draw as much attention as the phantom odor he hoped to conceal. Finally scrubbed and wearing a pressed button-down shirt, fresh khaki slacks, and a pair of Crockett and Jones dark brown Oxfords he'd be able to run in if the need arose, he headed to meet Midas in the lobby. The former Delta commander's nose curled as soon as Ryan walked up. "Like my granny used to say, you got something Babo won't wash off." "Damn it!" Jack grimaced and started to turn around and head back to his hotel room. "Seriously? You can still smell it?" Midas's wide shoulders bounced as he chuckled, already walking toward the valet with the keys. "You're fine," he said. "I think my nose hairs are still melted from when I picked you up." Chapter 40 Midas didn't mind navigating, so Ryan slid in behind the wheel of the Peugeot. He enjoyed driving a stick. It made him feel alive, even in the stop-and-go Buenos Aires traffic. He nearly ran over an older female pedestrian at a four-way intersection, which meant he was getting the hang of driving like an Argentine. She gave him an energetic up-yours gesture and called him pelotudo, which appeared to be the go-to word for angry people in this country. Ryan turned left on Avenida Santa Fe, working through what little they did know about the situation while he drove. The team had been over it until they were blue in the face, and there were a dozen plausible scenarios. But some vital piece of evidence that would make everything fall into place still eluded them. Eddie Fung was a Taiwanese national. Vincent Chen was also from Taiwan, but living in the United States with a cover identity, selling imported greeting cards from the People's Republic of China. So far, the only thing linking the two men was their propensity to frequent Trace Ecky's Sun Yi On Triad strip clubs that exploited underage girls, a trait that should have earned them both a spot in a very dark hole, but didn't explain Chen's connection to the PRC and whether he was friend or foe. The meetings between the Chinese and the other delegations had definitely brought him to Argentina. The Japanese girl added a new twist to the mix. The guy Ryan killed from Villa 31 had apparently been after her with a machete, which, by virtue of her enemies, edged her into the good guy column. Sometimes, though, the enemy of my enemy was, well, just another damn enemy. It was not too much of a leap to assume she was there because of the Japanese delegation. But ministers of agriculture rarely engendered enough intrigue to cause someone to run through a tunnel filled with sewage. And if this woman had arrived with the Japanese agricultural delegation, how did she even know about the existence of the tunnel? Jack had seen her exit the Palacio Duhao Hyatt, the same hotel where the Chinese foreign minister was staying. The Japanese had rooms at the Four Seasons, more than 5 blocks away. Why was she there? Why had she gotten to Villa 31 right after the brunette with known ties to Chen? She'd warned Jack to run. Why hadn't she confronted him? Or at the very least, left him to his own fate? Ryan tapped the steering wheel in thought. He had a lot of puzzle pieces. They just seemed to be from different puzzles. He passed the Parisia Aires Criollos restaurant on his right, and continued for another block and a half to a parking garage just beyond the intersection with Riobamba. A chilly wind blew in from the Rio de la Plata, which at 120 miles wide seemed more like a bay off the Atlantic than a river. Once he was parked, Ryan grabbed a dark windbreaker from the back of the Peugeot. It would cut the wind, and had the added benefit of being nighttime camouflage, should he need to move covertly when the sun went down. The men split up after they left the vehicle, Midas loitering his way east, browsing the shops along Santa Fe, while Jack went north a block on narrow, tree-lined Riobamba. Businesses occupied the bottom floor of most buildings, but judging from the many balconies above, most of the upper floors were private apartments. Ever thinking strategically, Jack noted the prevalence of concrete railings and statuary around the balconies, and thought how the Secret Service would avoid this kind of street like the plague. There were just too damn many places to hide. Pockets of old men with jaunty Tam-like gaucho hats sat here and there at the many sidewalk cafes on the quiet street, sipping yerba mate through a silver straw in a communal gourd called a mate that gave the drink its name. Mate was a national pastime. Entire shops were devoted to mate mugs and straws and thermoses, as well as exotic leather carriers resembling a tall binocular case in which to store everything. The hotel valet had offered Jack a drink from his mate straw, instructing him to empty it before passing it back. Jack had complied, grudgingly, and found it tasted like a mixture of boiling water and hay. He preferred to get his caffeine fix from actual tea, or a good old cup of coffee. The stuff made by the Navy stewards in the White House was particularly good, but he didn't get by there to see his folks as much as he used to. Certainly not as much as he should. It was a little after 4 p.m. when Ryan turned back to the east on Arenales, paralleling Santa Fe for several blocks so he could come in the opposite direction from Midas with the restaurant in the middle. The thought of Navy mess coffee made him wish for a cup, and he began to look for a likely shop as he walked. It would give him something to do as he whiled away the hours, and watched. In days gone by, arriving on station early was a double-edged sword. Get there too late and you missed important changes in personnel, local habits, and anyone from the other team who decided to set up an ambush or conduct counter-surveillance. Coming in too early ran the risk of drawing unwanted attention. Then smartphones came along and devoured the collective brain of society. Mobile phones were the single greatest thing